not only learned so much about you, two very close friends of mine, Bernard Herbert from Sydney and his son Gary Herbert from South Africa, speak about you forever and ever, and they say, how have you not yet met Nitsana? And I'm happy going to send them an email and tell them, no, we have finally met. I'm introducing you, and I'm sure they have a chance to sit. But Nitsana Darshan Leitner, to my eyes, is one of the modern-day heroes of Israel. We'll hear from her. If you haven't yet heard of Shirat HaDin, I'm sure most of you have heard of Shirat HaDin, you'll never forget what Shirat HaDin is all about. It is what the globe's number one international legal fighter against terrorism is Nitsana, and what she has done, what one woman has done with Shirat HaDin, with a cadre of people around the world working pro bono, with defending Israel in the legal sense and fighting terrorism, is absolutely unbelievable. I'm thrilled to be listening to you and meeting Nitsana and having her speak, and we welcome you being here today, and we thank you for making the time. Nitsana Darshan Leitner.
Liner was hijacked by a Palestinian terror cell. It was an Italian cruise liner. Its name was Aquila Lauro. When the terror cell hijacked the ship, they separated between the Jewish and American passengers to the rest of the passengers. And they warned the Israeli government that if they don't agree to release Palestinian prisoners, they will take each and every one of the Jewish and American passengers and kill them every 3 hours. Israel refused their demands, so they took the first victim, Leon Klinghoffer, an Israeli Jew from New York, on his wheelchair and shot him to death. Then they took his body on his wheelchair and threw it to the ocean. They did it in front of his wife. The mastermind behind this terror attack was Muhammad Abu Abbas. Muhammad Abu Abbas was able to escape to Egypt. Egypt didn't have a plane. He flew to Italy. In Italy, he was wanted by the American forces, but Italy let him run away. He ran to Iraq and was hiding there for many years. When the Oslo Accords were signed in the mid-90s, Abu Abbas was invited to come to Israel to take a vote regarding the Oslo Accords because he was a member of the Palestine National Council, which was supposed to approve the agreement. We were law students. I was a law student in Bar Ilan University. My friends were in Hebrew University, some in Tel Aviv University. And we decided that we are going to protest against the Israeli government decision to let Abu Abbas come in. As law students, we thought to bring a high court petition in the Supreme Court of the State of Israel. This is a way for the public to challenge the policy of the Israeli government. So we decided to bring up this high court petition, but we were only law students. We didn't have money to hire lawyers. The only way to overcome this obstacle is to become petitioners yourself. And then you have the right to argue before the Supreme Court. Then we had a discussion, who will argue? And they all pointed out to me. They said, you are a woman. If the court gets angry, they will not yell at you. and if they decide to dismiss the case, they will not hit you with a court fine. So that's what happened. We filed a petition, we had a court hearing scheduled. I was dressed in white and black, this is how you dress in court hearings in Israel, and went to the Supreme Court, scared out of my mind, but arguing before the Supreme Court, three judges in a panel. And I said, Abu Abbas is a terrorist, he has no right to enter Israel, he should not be welcome here. The Israeli government is the respondent in such type of petitions. They said that Abu Abbas had become Baal Tshuva. He no longer believes in terrorism. He wants to support the Oslo Accords, and he should be allowed to come in. The Supreme Court knew that they have a problem, because any decision that we give will be an immoral decision. You cannot let an archy murderer like Abu Abbas to enter Israel. And yet, their hands were tied because it's an Israeli government decision, and therefore they urged me to withdraw the lawsuit. I refused, and then they told me to go outside and consult with my clients. I don't have clients, but I went outside. And then when I came back, I told them that since Leon Klinghoffer's blood cries out of the depth of the ocean, I will not withdraw the lawsuit. The Supreme Court thanked me for my words and said they will give a decision in 2 weeks. When they gave a decision, they quoted my words. They said that although Leon Klinghoffer's blood cries out of the depth of the ocean, there is no way they can get involved with this Israeli government decision, and they dismissed the case. However, they said in these special circumstances, we are not going to make a court fine. That told us that we can bring cases on behalf of terror victims, or we can get to court against terrorism and get either in court. We may not win in the end, but we can bring up the issue, we can raise the awareness, and maybe one day we can even get a judgment in our favor. When the Intifada broke out in the year of 2000, we already got our license, we finished law school, became lawyers. We decided that we are going to fight back against the terrorism. We saw that the blood was spilled on the streets, and we saw that there is one way that the army cannot fight or the government cannot fight, which is the financial way, to go after the terror funding. We can do what lawyers do best, to go after the pocketbook of the terror organizations, because money is the oxygen of the terrorism. If you stop the flow of the money, you can stop the flow of the terrorism. We have here a mailing list for you to put your names and email addresses to get updates about our cases, decisions, which I'm going to speak partially about it. I cannot move with this thing, so maybe you can. Thank you. I promise not to spam. So maybe I would start with, maybe I will just tell you about some of our cases, how we actually fight terrorism in court. During the Intifada, the first years of the Intifada, there were banks that were helping Hamas to wire money into the Gaza Strip, into the West Bank. They did not do it directly. They were funding charities that supported the suicide bombers' families. And they had a system. If you were a father or a mother of a suicide bomber, if you were a child of a suicide bomber, you could have gone to the Hamas headquarters in Gaza, get a letter from them saying that you are a father, a mother, or a child of a suicide bomber, take this, get a letter approving that, take the letter to the banks in Gaza, show it to the bank managers, and the bank manager will give you rewards of many thousands of dollars. And ads were published all over the Arab world, If you want to support your brothers in the Palestinian Authority, if you want to help the Shahid, the martyrs, donate money to these specific bank accounts in Gaza. So people in Saudi Arabia know that if they donate money to specific bank accounts in Gaza, they can go back home, sit in their living rooms, watch Al Jazeera should be showing the ambulances, taking away the bodies of the dead, and the injured in Jerusalem. These banks were Arab banks, European banks, could have continued with this reward program until today, unless they made a little mistake. They ran this program of having a branch in New York. We realized that this is actually American jurisdiction over the bank. So there were lawsuits filed against these banks on behalf of terror victims that were killed or injured by Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PLO, seeking over $5 or $6 billion compensations. Some of the banks settled the cases. Some of them are still litigating. And the terror victims are going to get compensations for the horrible damages. I will just tell you about one of them, Hannah Nachenberg and her family. Hannah Nachenberg is a young woman from New York who lives in Israel. In August 2001, decided to take her family to eat pizza in the Sbarro Pizza Place in Jerusalem. Shortly after she entered the restaurant, a suicide bomber from the Hamas, wearing explosive vests, entered the restaurant and blew himself up. This was one of the famous suicide bombings in Israel in the first year of the Intifada, because it happened in the heart of Jerusalem. It actually happened right here, in the intersection between King George Street to Jaffa Street, the heart of the commercial district of Jerusalem. And everybody remember the famous sign of the Sbarro Pizza Place, lies down on the floor and around it all the dead and the injured. Hannah Nachenberg did not get killed in the attack. A metal pin entered her head and lined her brain. She went into irreversible coma. She was hospitalized in the Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. And after many months, when the doctors saw there was no improvement in her situation, she was moved to a medical center in Israel, and she's staying there until this day. Every day, her parents come to the hospital, sit near her bed, and pray. Since August 2001. On behalf of Hannah Nachenberg and the rest of the families of the terror victims, we'll take these cases until the end. But it's only to get the victim compensated. Because against the banks, against the way they were doing businesses, we already won. This lawsuit sent a shockwave toward the international banking system, that nobody agreed anymore to open bank account to a designated organization. Nobody agreed to open bank account to Islamic charity without making sure it's kosher, that it's not giving money to terror organizations, it's not raising funds for terror organizations, not identifying the terror organization. And nobody agreed to operate in terror zones like South Lebanon, like Gaza. There is no banking system in Gaza. This is why you see them smuggling money into Gaza with suitcases and cash from the tunnels. But that caused Hamas a great deal of harm because they need to bring hundreds of millions of dollars into the Gaza Strip. What they need the money for? We all attested it in the last war, in the summer, in Gaza. The reason the population in Gaza, let Hamas use them as human shields. Let them climb on the top of the roofs to warn the IDF not to shoot missiles towards the buildings. Sacrificing their own life. The reason the population in Gaza, let allow Hamas to shoot thousands of missiles towards Israel, utilizing their backyards, their kindergartens, their hospitals, is because Hamas provides the population in Gaza with all services they need from cradle to grave for free. They give them free education, free medical services, free social services to gain their loyalty. Hamas maintains a military. They have tens of thousands of soldiers. Sometimes they wear uniforms, most of the time they don't. But they always get paid on a monthly basis. Hamas supports its prisoners who are sitting in the Israeli jail. Thousands of them. They get a salary that ranges between $500 per month to $2,000 per month. Depends on the sentence you got, which depends on the number of Israelis you killed. And Hamas builds these sophisticated, modern, huge tunnels. You can drive a car inside them. They used to come from Egypt into Gaza to smuggle terrorists, ammunition, money. Today, they are going from Gaza into Israel to smuggle terrorists to kill us. To maintain all this infrastructure, Hamas budget stands today on $500 million. They cannot bring it through the tunnels. They need a bank. So after some years, they found a bank, an Asian bank, one of the biggest banks in the world. And again, we filed a lawsuit against this bank as well in New York on behalf of terror victims. And the bank immediately halted any transactions to Hamas. And these years, Hamas found new banks, Qatari banks, and Turkish banks that allow hundreds of millions of dollars to go into the Gaza Strip. But we intend to go after these banks as well. And we're going to do it on behalf of the three teenagers that were kidnapped and killed 2 years ago in Israel. Because this case illustrates how without money, there could have been no kidnapping. So there were three members of the Kawasma family that belonged to the Hamas organization sitting in Hebron and plotting how to help the Hamas prisoners who are sitting in the Israeli jail. Very quickly they reached the conclusion that the only way they can help the Hamas prisoners who are sitting in the Israeli jail is to kidnap Israeli soldier and then to negotiate with the Israeli government to release Palestinian prisoners. So they decided to kidnap an Israeli soldier. To kidnap the soldiers, they needed two cars. One to kidnap the soldier with, and another one to switch him to a new car in order to get rid of the old car, not to leave any trace of evidence. They also needed two M16s, because the soldier might be armed, and they needed two pistols in case something wrong will go in the car. To purchase all these things, they needed $65,000. $65,000 are a lot of money in Hebron, where the average salary is $300 per month. So they reached out to Al-Nur Charity. This is the front organization of Hamas, sits in Gaza and funded by Qatar, and asked for $65,000 and got the money. And then they went and bought two cars, two M16s, and two pistols. And then there was a Thursday night. The terrorists went to Gush Etzion Junction to wait for a soldier. It was the closest place to Hebron, but it was late at night. It was the weekend. There were no soldiers. There were three teenagers that finished school and wanted to come home. And the teenagers jumped into the car and called the terrorists as a surprise. The terrorists did not expect three young boys and decided to kill them. They shot them and then they continued with the plan. They went to the new car who was waiting for them, switched the teenagers to the new car, burned the old car, and went to the shelter, buried the teenagers in the ground. An entire country held its breath for 18 days until we found the teenagers. We cannot let them kill our children and keep silent. We will fight them back. We fought Iran, we fought Syria, we'll fight the Qatari and the Turkish banks. Another first one case we're litigating are cases against state-sponsored terrorism. Every time Iran or Syria, every time Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah carry out attacks against Israel, we can file a lawsuit against Iran, against Syria, against North Korea in the Federal District Court of Washington. Iran and Syria are pretty obvious. They fund Hamas, they fund Islamic Jihad, they give them ammunition, they provide them with all the missiles Hamas used in the last war. They give them shelter, they let them train in training bases in South Lebanon under their control. So we file lawsuits against Iran and Syria. They don't defend themselves. We get default judgment against them, usually for hundreds of millions of dollars. But what North Korea has to do with this story? So apparently North Korea, who doesn't have a lot of expertise, has only one. They know how to build underground tunnels. They went to Lebanon, sent their agents, and built the underground tunnels for Hezbollah that Hezbollah utilized to shoot missiles towards Israel in the second Lebanese war in 2006. So we got victims from this war and filed a lawsuit against North Korea in the Federal District Court of Washington and won a decision imposing liability on North Korea, and now we are working to prove the damages. But meanwhile, we were approached by a congressman who asked us if we can help a family of a priest from South Korea. His name is Reverend Kim, that helped refugees from North Korea to cross the border to China and escape. One day, the secret police of North Korea decided to stop the priest. They crossed the border to China, kidnapped the priest, and put him in a jail in North Korea. In the jail, the priest was tortured and starved to death. We agreed to help the family. We believe that a Jewish or Israeli civil rights organization helping Christians, helping people around the world for human rights violation, can endorse the Israeli or the Jewish approach. So we filed a lawsuit on the family's behalf in the Federal District Court of Washington against North Korea, and we lost the case. We lost the case because the judge said that although we have evidence that the priest was kidnapped from China, and although we have evidence that the priest was put in a political camp in North Korea, we don't have evidence that the priest died in jail. So we filed an appeal, and we called human rights experts and human rights organizations to file amicus briefs, and we explained what happened to political prisoners who are put in jail in North Korea, how they starved them to death, how they tortured them to death. And the court gave an unprecedented decision. The court actually overturned the burden of proof and said, indeed, the assumption is that the priest died in jail. And if North Korea has evidence to prove otherwise, they are very welcome to come to court and present them. And gave us a judgment against North Korea for $333 million. So now we have all these judgments against Iran, against Syria, against North Korea for hundreds of millions of dollars. And the big question is, how do you collect? In the beginning, we found bank accounts that belonged to the Iranian government, frozen accounts in the United States. We wanted to seize the money in the accounts. The State Department opposed us. The State Department wanted to have a say what to do with the money. They wanted it to be kept there for better days, that they have new relations with Iran. They didn't want the victims to receive the money. So we hired a lobbyist. We hired a former Undersecretary of State named Suet Eisenstadt that helped us to pass the law in the Congress, which overcame the objection of the State Department. And we were able to seize the money in the account and give it to the terror victims. We also found a house that belonged to the son of the Persian Shah. Years ago, when the son of the Shah wanted to become a pilot, His father sent him to Lubbock, Texas, where they have a big Air Force base and bought him a house. After the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the house became a property of the Iranian government. We learned about the house. We went to the sheriff in Lubbock, Texas, gave him our judgment, and asked him to force a sale on the house. The sheriff sold the house and gave us the money for the terror victims. Today we have liens on buildings in Queens, New York, and on a high, huge building in Manhattan called 650 Fifth Avenue, owned by the Iranian government, waiting to be sold, and the proceeds will go to the terror victims. Against North Korea, we found a boat that North Korea tried to smuggle weapon from Cuba with, who went on a reef on the Mexico Gulf. The UN approached the Mexican government and asked them to stop the boat, to seize it because North Korea is under sanctions. Mexico agreed. We hired a lawyer from Mexico City, and now we are putting lien on the boat. And if you're talking about the Islamic Revolution in Iran, let me tell you an interesting story. After the revolution in Iran, a lot of people tried to escape. Many Jews tried to cross the border from Iran to Afghanistan, walk all the way up to Turkey, and in Turkey take a plane to Israel, United States, or any other country in Europe. In 1994 and 1997, 12 Iranian Jews that tried to cross the border from Iran to Afghanistan disappeared somewhere along the border. Nobody knew what happened to them. The families went to the Iranian government to seek for information, but the Iranian government refused to give them any information. The families went and visited every jail in Iran, every hospital in Iran, every police station in Iran, asking if anybody knows what's happened to their sons, to their husbands, to their brothers, but nobody gave them any information. In the end, the families left Iran. Some of them moved to Israel. One family moved to LA. The neighbor of the family that moved to LA came to them and told them that while back in Iran, he was dealing with a major prison over there, it's called Evin Prison in Tehran, trying to sell them a land. In the course of the business deal, he was invited to the jail to take a tour, to learn what the needs of the prison are. He came to the jail, he took the tour, he was accompanied by one of the guards who took him along, and towards the end of the tour, they had to go downstairs 10 floors below ground. When they reached the 10th floor, the neighbor saw a very dark cell. He approached the cell, and he suddenly recognized the son of his neighbors that disappeared some years before. The boy was very excited. He thought that finally somebody came to rescue him. He approached the gate, but the neighbor was very afraid. Didn't say a word, and took a step back. In the end of the tour, they went upstairs, 10 floors up, and the neighbor, who couldn't hold himself, very carefully asked the guard, who were the prisoners that he saw in the dark cell? And the guard told him that they were Jewish prisoners who tried to escape from Iran. So now we know that these 12 missing Iranian Jews might be alive, might be sitting in a jail somewhere, and we wanted to raise public awareness for the case. Our way to do it is to file a lawsuit against any Iranian official that happens to be in the United States. But according to the law, we needed really to catch him in the United States and serve him with the complaints. So one day we hear that the former president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, is coming to the United States to be a speaker in the UN. We have good connection with the Persian community in LA. They somehow got a hold of his itinerary, and they saw that the next night he's going to be a speaker in a dinner that was held for him by CARE, Council of American Islamic Relations. We learned that for $400, you can buy a ticket for the dinner, and for additional $400, you can buy a photo opportunity with Khatami. So we hired a process server from Virginia, an ex-policeman, gave him our lawsuit plus $800. $400 for the dinner, $400 for the photo opportunity. He came to the dinner along with his wife. His turn to take the photo with Khatami arrived. He stood near Khatami, handed him the papers, told him that the families of 12 missing Iranian Jews are suing him in court. Khatami took the papers, and the photographer took the photo. The prosecutor, Severin and his wife, did not stay for dinner. Khatami had 20 days to answer the lawsuit. He failed, and we are waiting for the Virginia court to come down with a decision. When the court will give us a judgment, we know that Khatami has assets in Germany and France that we will try to go after, but this wasn't the reason why we filed the lawsuit. We filed the lawsuit to warn Iranian officials that if they leave Tehran, and once they leave Tehran, there will be courts, there will be process servers, there will be private lawyers that will indict them for the crimes against the Jewish people. When Israel's enemies realized that they cannot beat us militarily, that despite all the wars they launched against us, and despite the horrific wave of terrorism they unleashed against us, we are still here. They started to use a different type of weapon, an unconventional one, a very devastating one. It's called BDS and lawfare. They call people all around the world, companies, organizations, universities, co-ops, to boycott Israel, to sanction it, and to divest from it. They want to alien the Jewish state. They want to compare it to an apartheid state. They want to advance and to reach what they see as the solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, one-state solution, a Palestinian state. They call all the refugees from 1948, there were 600,000 at them back then, today there are 5 million, to come back to Israel, to settle in Israel under the slogan, let demography win. They don't want the Jewish state to exist. One of the attempts was the Gaza Flotilla. In May 2010, some of the BDS movement decided that they are going to breach the sea blockade that Israel had legally over Gaza. They claimed they're doing it for humanitarian reasons. The real reason was that they wanted to have a clash with the IDF soldiers on the high sea. They knew that Israel will not let them get near Gaza. They will have to send the Navy, and then there will be a fight between soldiers to civilians, and Israel will look again aggressive, and they will take these pictures and spread them all over the world, showing how IDF killing civilians. So they rented a big boat, a Turkish boat called the Mavi Marmara, and sailed towards Israel from Turkey. They reached, they gathered 500 people, they reached the territorial water of Israel. Israel sent the Navy asked them to stop, the Mavi Marmara refused, they said to them, you Jews, go back to Auschwitz. And then the Navy sent helicopters to the air, where they let Navy SEALs climb down with ropes to the boat. The Navy SEALs were unarmed because they believed there were only civilians on the boat. When they reached the bottom of the boat, there were terrorists from the IHH terror organization that almost killed the soldiers with poles, with metal sticks, with knives, with guns. There was a horrible battle on the boat. 10 of the terrorists got killed, and 9 of the IDF soldiers got severely injured. That caused a disaster for the state of Israel. Not only in terms of PR, They kept showing again and again the picture of the IDF soldiers beating up civilians. But in terms of foreign relations, Turkey threatened to break up relationship with Israel, and Prime Minister Netanyahu, under tremendous pressure of President Obama, almost paid $20 million to the families of the terrorists that got killed on the boat. And Turkey rushed and filed worker complaints against the IDF soldiers, issued arrest warrants against them, asked Interpol to turn these arrest warrants international, and they filing lawsuits against the soldiers all over the world demanding money. So the next year, the organizers wanted to repeat their success, but this time not with one boat, but with 15 boats, and not with 500 pro-Palestinian Muslim extremists, but with 1,500. They gathered all types of celebrities. They gathered famous authors like Alice Walker, the sister of law, Tony Blair, European Parliament members, all state cell from Greece, not from Turkey, who learns its lesson, and waited to the time that all coming towards Israel. We in Shuratadin were thinking, how can we stop the boats from sailing? We didn't want another clash on the high sea. We didn't want them even to leave Greece. What we as lawyers can legally block that all the boats need in order to sail. And we came up with the idea of maritime insurance. All the boats may need maritime insurance in order to sail, and no port will let any boat to sail without maritime insurance. So we sent warning letters to all the maritime insurance companies in the world. There are not so many of them, only 30. And we told them that if they insure the boats, they are adding and abetting a terror organization, because the end goal of the boat is to help Hamas in Gaza, which is a designated terror organization. And if they provide any type of service to a terror organization, they are risking civil and criminal liability in the United States for violating the Anti-Terrorism Act. The first company to answer us was Lloyd's of London, that said that indeed Hamas is a designated organization in Israel, United States, Canada, and Europe. They have no intention to insure the boat, and if we give them the maritime numbers of the boat, they will cancel their insurance. We consulted with the Israeli Navy, who gave us some numbers of the boats. We forwarded them to the insurance companies, and after a couple of days, we hear that 6 of the boats are canceling their participation because of lack of insurance. Then we asked the Navy what else we can go after, because our knowledge about boats is maybe about the Staten Island ferry. And they told us we should go after the satellite communication services. These are the GPS, the telephone, the internet. They're all covered in the Middle East by one company. It's called Inmarsat. We asked where they sit. They told us Dubai. But then when we Googled the name, we saw that they have offices in Miami and London as well. So we warned Inmarsat, but Inmarsat ignored us. So we took them to court. We filed an injunction against them in the court in Miami. And after 3 days, we read in the New York Times that the biggest boat of them all, the Mavi Marmara, is canceling its participation in the flotilla because lack of insurance and other communication problems. Then we got a hold of Governor Perry, Governor of Texas. Governor Perry heard me in one of his visits to Israel. In the end of my lecture, he came, he said, I love what you do. I love what Shuratadin does. It's amazing. It's such a great work. If you ever need my help, please don't hesitate to call. And you know us Israelis, we don't hesitate to call. So we asked Governor Perry if he'll be willing to send a letter to the Attorney General of the United States asking why he's not going after those who raise funds for the flotilla in the United States, because this is a violation of the Neutrality Act. Don't ask me how we came up with the Neutrality Act. It's an old law. It was legislated in 1789. It's an anti-piracy law. when the boats from England and Holland were coming down to the Caribbean, they were crossing the coast of the United States and they were attacked by American pirates. So young American government legislated a law saying that no one in the United States can take part in a hostile act against a friendly state of the United States, and specifically prohibited anyone in the United States to take part in a naval expedition against a friendly state to the United States. Israel is an ally of the United States. Governor Perry sent the letter. It was published all over the media that now the United States might go after those who respond to the flotilla. And lastly, we approached a law firm in Greece, asked them to approach the port authorities in Greece, demanding that the port authorities will go and check all the boats which are waiting to set sail, if they fit to sail, if they have maritime insurance, if they have satellite communication services, and to check their form. We learned that according to the Greek law, every boat that wants to leave Greece has to fill up a voyage form where they must indicate which port they are leaving and which port they are going to. We know that none of the boats can fill into destination Gaza because Gaza did not have a port and it was illegal, according to the international law, to travel to Gaza. So when the port authorities came and checked all the boats and they reached the form, they saw that everybody lied on their form and put Alexandria, Egypt, as their destination. The port authorities got very mad and impounded all the boats. That afternoon, the organizer of the flotilla held a press conference in Greece, saying that because of this law organization, Shuratadin from Tel Aviv, that spreads lies against them, they don't have a choice but to cancel the flotilla. How long we have?
10 minutes. When you finish responding to that, you can leave time for questions if you want to.
So, maybe I'll tell you about our recent case. Anybody know about our recent case? Anybody know about the lawsuit against Facebook? Okay, that sounds better. So, you know, today you cannot walk on the street of Jerusalem without looking back, without making sure nobody is stabbing you with a knife. And you wonder who really carried out these attacks. And you find out that there are teenagers. Teenagers, 16 years old, 17 years old, 13 years old boys who are just grabbing knives and stabbing Jews. And then there's a question, what drives these teenagers? What brings them to carry out knives and stab Jews? So I'll tell you what drives them. It's incitement. But the incitement who used to be in the town squares, on the streets, in the mosques, or in leaflets getting printed and giving out to the people near you, today is going on in the social media. You will find tens of thousands of posts calling to kill Israelis. Pages called Stab Jews. Videos illustrating how to stab with a knife. What type of poison to put on the knife before you go and stab. How to twist the knife, where exactly to stab. How to ambush the Jews to separate them between them to tourists. And then you see that these young people, before they get up and stab, post on Facebook that they are going to be a shaheed. They are going to start a third intifada, that it's time to liberate Al-Aqsa. And after they go and stab, you will find thousands of posts endorsing their acts, glorifying it, encouraging others to follow them. All this incitement is stirring up inflaming this violence that was going on in recent months in Israel. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel approached Facebook, which is the most popular social network media in among the Palestinians, and asked them to shut down the incitement, asked them to take down all these posts. But Facebook said that they are not getting involved with the content, that they are a free platform and everybody can put his views on their pages. So we decided to sue Facebook. We called Israelis to join the lawsuit, and within 3 days we got 20,000 Israelis joining the lawsuit, authorizing the law firm in New York to file a lawsuit against Facebook. And a month ago we filed it in the court in New York. We asked for injunction. We asked that Facebook not only take down the posts that are calling to kill the Israelis, but actually be proactive and monitor the incitement itself. And Facebook has the tools to do it. The same book Facebook knows what type of coffee I drink in the morning and what I like to wear and push me ads accordingly and offer me friendship with people that have the same interests as me and offer me to join groups. They have the ability to track those who incite to murder to those who actually want to get up and do it. And just to prove that Facebook can really get involved, and the question is just to which side, we opened two identical pages. One calls to kill Israelis, one call to kill Palestinians. We posted identical posts and put identical images, just with one difference, one against Jews, one against Palestinians. And after 2 days, we asked Facebook to take the two pages down. Facebook immediately took down the page that called to kill Palestinians and left on the page that called to kill Israelis. We're fighting back. This is only a portion of the cases we're handling in Israel, United States, Europe, and Canada. Every day, we get more and more calls from more and more terror victims who want to fight back, who are seeking justice, who more than anything else in the world don't want to be victims anymore. And we are dedicated to help them. We established Rapidin, Israel Law Center, to take all these hundreds of cases and find them in orderly manner in the courts around the world. We will fight terrorism in courts. We'll go on the offense against Israel enemies because we can win the cases. We're doing it because we are winning the cases. Last January, I had to spend the coldest month in my life in New York in a case that we filed against the Palestinian Authority on behalf of 10 families that lost their loved ones in the most heinous terror attacks in Israel during the first years of the Intifada. For instance, Jonathan Bauer, who was 7 years old, when he was walking one day, holding his father's hand on Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem, where a big man were coming towards them. They didn't know then that the big man was a Palestinian policeman. But they also didn't know that this big man was carrying a vest. And in the vest, there were nuts and bolts and little pins and screws and everything he could have carried in addition to the explosive vest. And then the man looked at Jonathan's eyes and blew himself up. Jonathan fell on the floor, so did his father. They were rushed to Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. And for 4 days, the doctors were fighting on Jonathan's life. They did hundreds of operations on him, taking each and every pin from his brain. And in the end, they woke him up, and they told the father that there is one less pin that they left in the brain, because every move of it may terminate his life. We represent Jonathan and his family, along with the other families, in the lawsuit in Manhattan against the Palestinian Authority, because all these attacks were done by Palestinian employees, Palestinian policemen, Palestinian security guards, Palestinian 417 officials. So the Palestinian Authority, as the employer, is responsible. They hired a lawyer, they came to court, they had several allegations, but in the end they came to trial and had a defense. They said that these employees were indeed their employees, but they were rogue employees. They did the attacks in the afternoon. They did not have any permission to carry out attacks. They were not authorized. It wasn't the policy of the PA, neither of the PLO, to kill Jews during the Intifada. But when the trial opened, they found it very hard to explain to the jury how, until this day, they still support these terrorists who were convicted in these terror attacks or sitting in the Israeli jail. How they keep paying their salaries years later. How they promote them in rank. How they pay compensations to their families. How they give money to the families of the suicide bombers. How they endorse the terrorism and they call town squares on the name of the shaheed, of the terrorist. This is not how you treat wrong employees. This is not how you behave if you don't call and endorse to kill Jews. There was no surprise there that after 2 months, when the jury came down from liberation, they found the PA and the PLO responsible for the attack and gave us a judgment against them for $655 million. We're winning the cases. We will keep fighting terrorism in court because we can do what governments cannot do. Governments cannot sue other governments. They cannot sue banks, they cannot sue Facebook or any entity. They are constrained. They have political considerations. They have foreign relations they have to take into consideration. They have to be politically correct. We don't. We are private lawyers that represent private people that have one goal, to bankrupt terrorism one lawsuit at a time. And we will fight terrorism in court because we don't have any other choice. We live in Israel. We want to send our kids to school and make sure they're coming back safe. We want to walk in our streets without looking back. We want to sit in our cafes, we want to shop in our malls, we want to live safely in our country. And this is our country. We're sick and tired going with parents to funerals and watching them little saying Kaddish on their children. And we are sick and tired sitting in the military courts, watching the defendants from the Hamas who are looking at the judge as smiling at him and promising him that they will win. They will not win. We will win because we are fighting for our national survival. The Torah taught us, Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Don't stand idly by your brother's blood. We will not stand idly by our brother's blood. We cannot afford it. The state of Israel cannot afford it. You cannot afford it. Join us in this fight. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is running a few minutes back. Can we have some questions? Is that okay?
Sure.
I'll start with a question. It's unbelievable presentation.
Thank you.
Inspiring. How do you manage to do that? So, meaning, do you have people, do you have other law firms which partner with you? Is it pro bono? I mean, how do you manage to, you know, run a private law firm in Tel Aviv with such an international...
Right. Yes, so we have an office in Tel Aviv. In the office, we have 10 lawyers who are working. This is our staff. But we have many law firms around the world which are our co-counsels in all the different cases. These lawyers are mostly Jewish lawyers, but not only. And they all work either pro bono or on a contingency basis, meaning that if there is a case that will win in the end, they will get paid for their work. We cannot afford paying attorney's fees for lawyers. We do carry out the expenses. We pay for all the litigation expenses, all the court filings, and this is very, very costly. This is why we have to raise funds for the litigation. It's a non-profit organization, and we don't get funded by governments, not even by the Israeli government. Not that we didn't ask, but it's good this way. This is why we can sue the Israeli government if we want to. And it's a big struggle because we get all the support. We get all the funding, and yet we have to pick up and work with each and every law firm on its own terms, on its own conditions, but it's working. We found that it really works. Yes.
I want to know, why are you suing from America and using American law? Why can't you sue the charter organizations in Israel? Additionally, I want to know that if you're using American law, if you only sue if the victim are Americans, what do you do then if you have Israeli victims who are there already?
Very nice question. So, we don't sue only in the United States. We have cases litigated in Israel, in Canada, and the United States. In the beginning, we did file cases in the United States only on behalf of American citizens. In the United States, there are two laws that allow American citizens that got hit in a terror attack abroad to bring cases in the United States. One is against state-sponsored terrorism, and this is done by an exception for the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. Usually, you cannot bring lawsuits against states. States have sovereign immunity. States cannot function if they will be sued on a daily basis. So there is an international law idea that gives immunity to states. However, in the United States, the Congress was very angry that American victims, American citizens, get killed and there is no one to sue. So they made an exception, and you can file a lawsuit in the Federal District of Washington against state-sponsored terrorism if they are listed in the watchlist of the State Department. You can sue Iran, you can sue Syria, you can sue North Korea, and others. There is another law, which is called the Anti-Terrorism Act, that allow American citizens to bring lawsuits against terror organizations. And this is a very exceptional law, because what if the terror organization is not active in the United States? What jurisdiction you have? And yet, Congress once again said that if the American citizens get killed in terror attacks abroad, United States jurisdiction should be the proper forum to deal with the case. That was in the beginning. Later on, we realized that we actually can bring lawsuits on behalf of Israelis as well in the United States. And this is by simply utilizing the Israeli tort law. And we brought many cases against banks on behalf of Israelis, which are still pending, meaning that the court accepts our allegation that the choice of law can be according to the Israeli law. Parallel to all these cases, we have many, many cases going on in Israel that we filed in the first years of the Intifada. I must say that the Israeli courts are a little bit more reluctant than from pursuing these cases. In the beginning, they saw them political cases. They didn't want to get involved to this side or another, as opposed to the American courts who did not care. Who was the conflict was very far away from them, and they decided to rule on the case based on evidence only. This is why we have many judgments in the United States already, but none in Israel. Okay. You had another question? No, that's two questions. Yes.
I was just wondering, in general, the fact that you're suing terror organizations should be viewed as good for everyone, at least from the Israeli side, but I think your organization is definitely perceived to some extent as fitting somewhere on the political spectrum. So I wanted to know, do you view your organization as being part of, let's say, the right-wing camp of the political spectrum, or do you view it as just good for all Israelis and not really?
Right. In Israel, being national is being right-wing. If you act in favor of the state, you usually perceived as a right winger. I believe that, it's not my belief, but in fact, we represent and help all people from all spectrums in the state of Israel. We represent from the far left, and not to the far right, to the far left and a little bit in the center. To the right. We didn't have to represent really, really far right-wing people. Because when a bus blows up in Israel, it doesn't distinguish between leftists to right-wing people. They just kill everyone. As a matter of fact, the case against Facebook, which we recently filed, the first plaintiff, the main leader of the lawsuit. His name is Lakin. This is how the case called, Lakin. He was an activist in Tag Meir organization. Tag Meir organization is a response to Tag Mechir. Price tag, in Israel, in Hebrew it sounds the same. So Price Tag is the organization. Do you know about Price Tag? Price Tag is the organization that retaliate against Palestinian violence in violent ways. So Tag Meir is the contra left-wing organization to Tag Meir, whatever. He believes in peace. His Facebook page is pictures of Jewish kid along with a Jewish, with the Arab kid. All his posts is endorsing two-state solution. He was far to the left, and he is the main plaintiff in the Facebook page. So we really don't distinguish. In addition, we represent Arabs as well. In the lawsuit against Lebanese Canadian Bank in the United States, we represent many victims from the Second Lebanese War, and those include Druze and Muslims, and Christians, and Bedouin, all the people who live up in the north and got hit with the missile attacks. We also represent Palestinian undercover agents that were tortured by the Palestinian Authority. We have cases there. We have in Israel, in the United States. So it really, when it comes to terrorism, human rights violation, we have no separation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mitsana, on all of our behalf. I know for me personally, and I'm sure for all of you, to see how one person, one woman can make such an unbelievable impact, literally affecting Jewish destiny on a daily basis on the broadest possible international forum, and in the area of lawfare, which, as Mitsana said, is such a major, major area of warfare today. It's been so inspiring. These are young men and women from the United States, mainly in other diaspora communities, who've taken off time to come and study in their winter break in Israel. And I think it's so inspiring that each and every one of us can be, inspired. This is a leadership seminar. about leadership in general, religious Zionism in particular, and Nitzana is a shining example of perhaps giving us, all of us, something to aspire to, use our qualities to fight for the things we believe in about Jewish destiny. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a 5-minute break. Rabbi Riskin will be here in 5 minutes, so please don't go far. We're going straight from Rabbi Riskin straight into Rahel Frankel. So please have a 5-minute break, don't go far, and come sit today.